Modern smartphones are sleek and thin, but they're also fragile and expensive. If you're really careful, you may use it until you're ready to upgrade without shattering the glass. But if you look around, you'll see most phones wrapped in a case for protection. Our personal data is even more valuable than the device it's stored on, and it deserves just as much protection. The work that I do requires me to travel a lot, which means I'm frequently connected to unfamiliar networks. Nefarious hackers can make up to $1,000 selling the data of each of their victims on the dark web, and there are cheap hardware and software tools readily available that let even a smart middle schooler snatch your data without you even noticing. A virtual private network, or VPN, like ExpressVPN, creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your devices and the servers that you're transmitting data to and from. When you're sitting at the airport gate area, or airline lounge, or even your hotel room, those Wi-Fi networks aren't secure. Your bits are flying through the air, and whether you're checking your bank account balance, sending data to a client, or just checking your email, bad actors can snatch up your usernames, passwords, and everything else you send and receive if it's not encrypted. The layers of security used by ExpressVPN would take over a billion years to expose by bad guys with some of the most powerful supercomputers. ExpressVPN trusted server technology also runs each session in memory in a unique virtual space that is wiped clean as you end your session, with none of your data ever written to a hard drive, so there's no residue for anyone to recover about what you were doing after the fact. ExpressVPN runs on almost all devices, including Windows, Mac, iOS, Linux, Android, streaming devices like Chromecast, Roku, Fire Stick, and Apple TV, and there's also a Chrome browser extension. It's super simple to use. Once you install ExpressVPN, it's one click to establish a secure encrypted tunnel with servers in 105 countries around the world. I've personally been paying for and using ExpressVPN for years on all of my personal devices. When I first started using VPNs for work more than 20 years ago, they were often slow and unstable and had to be restarted frequently. But with ExpressVPN, data speeds are virtually unchanged from running fully exposed, so you can just turn the VPN on and leave it on. I often get materials from clients and companies that are under embargo or NDA, and if it leaks out, I can get into some trouble. But even if I just wanted to reach back to my personal server to grab some files, check my email, or watch something that's only available on one of my streaming services at home while I'm out of the country, ExpressVPN lets me do it all securely. Your data is valuable. Don't let bad actors steal it and potentially misuse it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. That's expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And you can get an extra 3 months free when you sign up. Expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. And thanks to ExpressVPN for supporting Wheelbearings.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abu Al-Samad from Navigant Research.
I'm Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives.
So we're here for a special episode, or at least a special theme, right? Because we saw the Mustang Mach-E debut. We talked about it on the last episode, which just posted, but now we can actually talk about it. And Sam, you were there at the event that Ford held. And, you know, it looks like it's actually more revolutionary than the original Mustang, the Mustang Mach-E. And, you know, let's set aside the naming controversy for now, because I feel like that's generated lots of heat and very little light. and, you know, I want to just start with one interesting tidbit I discovered with all the chatter was that the Mustang brand, not necessarily Ford, but Ford or Ford Mustang, but just Mustang, is actually pretty strong in China. And so I have to imagine that that's one of the things that plays into naming this thing, is Ford maybe eyeing the EV market in China for it as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, since 2014, when the current generation Mustang Coupe, the S550, debuted, you know, Mustang has been, they have expanded it from being a North American model to a global model. You know, it's available in, I think, over 130 countries now, and including China and throughout Europe, as well as, you know, other parts of Asia. And, you know, it has gained a lot of traction. And, you know, the last several years, it's actually being the number one selling sports coupe globally, beating out everything else. And that's, I would say that is absolutely one of the factors that led them to adopt the Mustang name for this thing. Mustang obviously is an iconic nameplate for Ford. That and F-150, or F-Series, are the two strongest brands that they have, probably. And that was, that kind of drove this whole decision to pivot the whole program.
Well, and it's actually really interesting. I didn't mean to jump right into facts and figures too. Look, what do you guys think? It's Rebecca, you've gotten your eyes on this. What do you think of it? Does it live up to Mustang? You were a little not so convinced when we last talked.
Well, I just knew that there was going to be a lot of backlash from consumers and Mustang purists, as there always are. But I think it's the right strategy. I think it takes advantage, as Sam said, of really one of their best global nameplates, instantly recognizable. And it expands, I tried to think of it as more of like a body style and a powertrain expansion or propulsion expansion of the Mustang lineup. And the reality is, this is where vehicles are going today. They're going to these crossovers. They're going to, a more practical utility. And I do think, based on what I saw last night at the reveal and what I'm seeing online, I think it looks really nice. I think the proportions of it are really nice. I love the fact that it has that big long hood, even though it doesn't need it, for the engine. I think they did a nice job. They really honored that the Mustang nameplate. I think that the fact that it gets 300 miles of range is fantastic. Some of the stats on it, the 0-60 mark, I love the fact that they brought out the GT Performance right away. I think that they really did a good job of being a good steward of the brand, which we talk about a lot on this show. We've talked about other brands that maybe aren't as good stewards. I think the Ford really honored the Mustang nameplate. Maybe not in the way some people think of it, but some people need to expand their view.
Well, Sam, you had a really interesting sort of deep dive on Forbes about the Mach-E, and you noted that initially this was supposed to be kind of a layup, to score some points. And that was probably before it actually had the name Mustang Mach-E. But as part of Ford's electric vehicle and electrification program back in 2017, it was a compliance car. And it switched from that kind of, use the basketball metaphor, that it switched from a layup to a full court press, which is the kind of all-encompassing strategy that wins, entire championships. And Jim Hackett is really getting credit for that with the formation of Team Edison.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with these sports ball metaphors that you keep referencing.
Hey, but, do the things.
I'll try to play along. For anyone that didn't read my 4,500 word treatise on this thing.
You should go do that now. Yeah, you should definitely do that.
A little bit of background. Ford, like every other automaker, especially at least every other volume automaker, has been required to sell a certain number of plug-in vehicles in California and other states, as well as in other markets, to comply with regulations. They're trying to shift to zero emission vehicles, and they for several years they offered the Focus Electric, which was totally a compliance car, and it was, very much non-optimized for the task. It was a car that was not designed to be electric to begin with, and they managed to stuff a bunch of batteries in there and a motor
to make it an electric, but it didn't have particularly good range and it was expensive. And, you know, 2016, they were working on, you know, a replacement for that, a next generation, which was, you know, a front wheel drive crossover. And for all intents and purposes, you know, you could think of it, you know, essentially as kind of an electric Escape. You know, it was a little bit larger than Escape, but not by a whole lot. But it was effectively an electric Escape. And when in January of 2017, when Mark Fields, then CEO of Ford, announced that they were going to produce a 300-mile electric crossover, that was the vehicle he was talking about. And a few months later, when he was fired and Jim Hackett was brought in as CEO, you know, part of what happened in the months following Hackett, you know, coming in as CEO, was they went through and completely reevaluated all the product programs at Ford. And one of the things that was decided between Hackett and the rest of the leadership team, including Jim Farley, was that, you know, rather than doing another compliance car, you know, even though this was going to be a purpose-built EV, it was still very much, you know, something that they were doing because they had to do. You know, they decided that they needed to do something else, something completely different that was actually going to excite consumers, you know, and actually get them to want to own an electric Ford rather than Ford having to push it on consumers. And, you know, they formed Team Edison, you know, which was, you know, this team that was set up to look at, you know, product planning and marketing and business models around electrification. What are the things that Ford would have to do to really be successful in electrification? And so they basically started from scratch. You know, they used some of the hardware, some of the technology that they developed, but they completely reconfigured it and started with a whole new vehicle. And it was really Farley that pushed for the use of the Mustang name. You know, and the reason for that is that he wanted to inspire the team, but also to inspire customers. And he felt that if we're going to call this thing a Mustang, then it has to be like a Mustang. It has to have the attributes, the driving dynamics and performance of a Mustang and some of the looks of a Mustang. Otherwise, there's no point in calling it that, you know, unless you do, in fact, want to destroy the brand. And, you know, so they pulled together a team and they started over again. They went from a front-wheel drive crossover to a rear-wheel drive / all-wheel drive machine that was really targeted more for performance. You know, they stretched the wheelbase, they completely changed the design, and you know, they Dave Parasek, who was the former chief engineer for Mustang, and then after that he was the director of Ford Performance, and led Ford's GT program. You know, going back to Le Mans and winning with the GT, you know, he is now the director of Icons. Icon vehicles at Ford, and you know, Icons include Mustang, Bronco, Raptor, and now the Mach-E. And you know, we talked earlier this summer with Amy Marentek about the whole Icons group, and on Friday I had a chance to sit down with Dave for a few minutes and talk about what, you know, what he saw as the need, you know, what did he feel that it was required to make this vehicle be a Mustang. And you know, if you want, we can drop that in here, Dan, and then we can pick up the conversation after that.
Sure, absolutely. Let's go to your interview with Dave Parasek.
Dave, director of Icons now,
right?
And you've got a long history with Mustang, and you know, this is the first really all new product as part of the Icons group. I talked to Amy Marentek a few months ago about, you know, what the Icons thing is all about.
Yeah.
And now you're adding something completely different to Icons. You know, it's not a Mustang. Well, I mean, it's not a traditional Mustang. It's not a GT.
It is a Mustang.
Yeah. What, you know, from your perspective, you've been part of Mustang for so long, and it's been part of you for so long.
Yeah.
What did you want to achieve with this vehicle to really make it a Mustang?
Sure. Well, I mean, number one, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to actually bring an all-new Mustang into the lineup, right? Because this is something that, as we look in the future of the brand, this is going to be critical to us being here another 55 years from now, right? So, but to make it truly a Mustang, its driving dynamics had to be just no compromise. Had to be, right? And so we made a lot of late change in the program. I mean, you'll hear a story of when I went down to the simulator and the team thought they were done. I drove it and I came out and I looked at it and I said, no way, this is not a Mustang. And we spent the next month or more, you know, adding bracing to stiffen up the body, changing bushings. I mean, we were doing all kind of stuff because it just didn't have the driving dynamics that it needed to have. And so first and foremost, it had to drive and feel like a Mustang. And the cool part about it is, and this is where I get excited about it, is when you add that instantaneous torque to that awesome, you know, driving dynamics that you would expect out of a Mustang, it's just magic, man, because who doesn't want instantaneous torque? And so what we've been able to achieve with this, and so that's, it's magical when all those things happen and come together, right? So we made a lot of change, Sam. I mean, I'll tell you, we changed tires, we changed suspension, you know, we added Magna Ride to the GT, we lowered the GT, we changed the steering tuning. I mean, you name it, everything sort of got revamped when we pivoted the program and said, we're gonna make a Mustang. And so what I was looking to achieve was bringing that legendary Mustang performance, feel, the whole thing, and bringing it in a new way, bringing it in a totally different silhouette and bringing it into this instantaneous torque world that we have with electrification. It's amazing. It's awesome.
You know, Mustang's always been a rear-wheel drive coupe convertible.
Yep.
Describe, you know, what you're looking for in terms of driving dynamics in something that's called a Mustang.
Yeah. So, I mean, what you're looking for is you're looking for the acceleration has to be there when you want it. So, especially as you set the car up in the corners, right? One of the things that a Mustang is really magical about is, you know, you've been driving them long enough, is as you're going through turns and corners, is you can set that, you set it up into the corner, and then when you rock it out of the other side of the corner with that, right, she's gripped, it's almost like it's on rails, and you got that instant acceleration coming out of there, and all of it's connected together. The biggest thing about a Mustang is all of the systems work together to just give you a driving experience that you can't get anywhere else. So, again, that all that transfers into this vehicle.
So what did it take to make, first of all, an all-wheel drive vehicle that is significantly taller than a Mustang and larger footprint? What did it take to make a vehicle of that form factor feel like, you know, an S550 Mustang?
It takes quite a bit, actually, because all-wheel drive does give you a totally different, you know, driving dynamic. But we're not unfamiliar with how to make an all-wheel drive version of a performance vehicle. Look at the Focus RS.
Right.
I mean, I think it's amazing. We learned a lot with that product on how to make an all-wheel drive do what we want it to do from a performance perspective. So the same team that does those types of products, we're working on this one as well. And so we know all the tricks of the trade in order to make the all-wheel drive system perform so that you don't, you know, the front end and rear end are working 100% harmonious together.
You know, you've got three different configurations: a rear-wheel drive, a front drive with a, or an all, sorry, all-wheel drive with a smaller motor, and then the dual motor configuration, the same motor front and rear.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the ones with either just the rear or the larger rear, they're probably going to have more of that kind of rear bias kind of feel, that more like a traditional Mustang. You know, and did you try to emulate some of that with the GT, you know, in terms of the way it behaves, you know, maybe make it be able to do a little power over steer or things like that, or drifting?
Yeah, those are all the characteristics that you would expect to have, right? Mustangs are known not to have too much understeer, but have just the right amount. Right?
These modern Mustangs.
Yeah, modern Mustangs. And the back end, you know, you want to be able to rotate that vehicle. And so that was one of the things that as we worked on the all-wheel drive system, all the versions of it, when I was in the simulator or even on the track just recently, it's getting that proper rotation of that rear end coming around, especially in an SUV, is not an easy task. But we know how to do it. You know, there's all kind of tricks that we play. But yeah, you want that feel that you would expect of being able to rotate that vehicle when you want to, and be able to get that rear end to go where you want it to go, point and shoot that front end, tuck it into the corners. Yeah, I mean, she does all of it.
What's the suspension architecture of the Mach-E?
It's your coil suspension. I mean, it's
struts in the front,
yep.
Multi-link in the
yep.
rear.
Yep.
Is it an integral link like the other Mustangs, or is it a different kind of rear
It's
end?
A different kind of rear.
Okay. What,
in terms of steering, you know, what have you done with steering to make this, you know, feel like what you expect a Mustang to do?
Yeah, I mean, same people that would tune the Mustang steering has also tuned this vehicle here. So we have, you know, with the E-Pass systems, we have all the ability to change all the different levers to be able to make it perform the way we want it to perform. So you'll see that the steering is progressive depending on the drive modes that you're in and that you're using. But it's typical what you expect is that you're going to get that more of a point and shoot kind of a steering. So it's not twitchy or overly aggressive, but it is very linear and very accurate. So I always say it's point and shoot with Mustang, right? Put it where you want it to go.
Yeah. You mentioned the simulator, the Ford Performance Simulator down in North Carolina.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit more about that and the capabilities that has and what that allowed you to do?
Yeah, a simulator is amazing. We started that many years ago when I was actually leading Ford Performance. And the technology was good, but I wouldn't say it was great. But what we did was through the use of it with our GT racing program and our NASCAR racing program, we've been able to take that technology to a level that is absolutely amazing now. I mean, you won't get NASCAR drivers on it every day of the week if it's not good, if it's not real, right? And we learned a lot about how to make that system real. It is so accurate now that we go down there and we can change setups on the fly, right? Change springs, change shocks, change bushings, change tires, and just you can try a million iterations and decide what you like and don't like and how it works. And when I went down there and drove this one, it is so accurate that just by changing the tires, I could tell, you know, it was like a blind test for me, right? And they would make a change and I'd come, oh, I think you just changed the tires. Yeah, we did. And, you know, and we talked about that. So the technology is truly amazing. And what we have proven now in a couple of different programs, we even used it a little bit on the GT500. This was the first program we've used it really from start to finish, but we did use GT500. What we determine in the simulator and when we build the first prototype, that translation is extremely accurate. So what we drove in the simulator and we get in behind the actual physical vehicle, it's like, yep, I just drove this. I've been there. So I did that back-to-back with the GT500 at VIR Raceway. So drove it in the simulator, said, yep. Flew right down to VIR and drove into the real car. Absolutely was identical to what I was in the simulator. And so that translation is amazing. Cuts out a lot of costs and cuts out a lot of time for us as we develop these products.
One of the things that Mustang fans have always appreciated is the sound of the car, especially in V8 form. And obviously in an EV, that's not something that you're going to have. What was the goal in terms of creating a soundtrack for the Mach-E?
Thanks.
Yeah, so obviously the sound of a Mustang is part of the visceral experience, right? We call it on the V8 Mustang, it's its mating call, right? So when we took this project on, we knew that sound was going to be really important to the overall driving experience, but clearly this just doesn't have a V8 in it. It doesn't, you know, so you don't try to mimic something that would be completely unrealistic and not authentic. And Mustang's all about being authentic. But you do have an EV, and EVs don't make a lot of noise, so... you do have the eDrive system, which does produce some sound, right? And so we've enhanced that sound where appropriate. But then we had to figure out, what should this sound like? What would if you try to imagine a Mustang as an electric vehicle, what would it sound like? Because I'll tell you what, watching a movie without sound is kind of boring, mm-hmm. right? Well, it's no different here. I mean, you don't want to go out and have fun driving a Mustang and not have any sound. So we spent a lot of time to figure out, what should that sound be? Everything from the Jetsons to, you know, I mean, you name it, right? Weird Star Trek-y sounds to you name it. And at the end of the day, we came up with a sound that we felt was Mustang-like, but again, not trying to simulate anything that we've had in the past, not trying to simulate V8s or anything like that, but wanting to give you that exciting, exhilarating feel as you accelerate. And we feel that we've hit it. It was many, many hours of agonizing and going back and forth and questioning ourselves and questioning each other. But at the end of the day, I think the sound that we ended up with is pretty cool.
So, what are you going to have in your garage? Grab her blue GT?
It would be a GT for sure. I will wait for the GT. Yeah, I don't know. You know what? The car looks great in white. It looks great in grabber blue. But I'll tell you, I'm excited to drive this, you know, out on the streets. I mean, I've had it on tracks. I've had it.
Yeah.
But I just can't wait. I mean, it's really fun. I mean, I had a whole carload of people the other day out on the track in it, and we were just having a blast out.
Yeah, well, it was impressive on the short drive we had. So, all right. Dave Parasek, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, you know, I'm just kind of struck by the decision to not create any more compliance cars. That's what this feels like to me, is Ford saying, no, we're going to do a strategy that takes investment and risk now, which is maybe uncomfortable, but we're going to avoid scrambling in the future, because, you know, cars are a reactive business. And this looks to me like Ford's trying to avoid having to take EVs seriously in the future by taking them seriously now.
I would agree with that to a point, but it is also there is some reactivity to it, because I think, you know, kind of the short answer to what Ford has done is they've essentially looked at the only company that has been successful in terms of, you know, selling EVs to consumers, even though the business has not been successful, but, you know, getting consumers to want EVs is Tesla. And they basically took all the best parts of the Tesla playbook and combined that with, hopefully, you know, with what are the areas of Ford's strength in manufacturing and design and development and customer support, and, you know, meld that into this vehicle.
One of the things that Tesla has really shown us is what consumers want when they look at adopting electric vehicles. And we have to still remember that even though there's a lot more electric vehicles coming out, we are still dealing with the very, very beginning of the technology adoption curve, because we're still looking at new car sales in that like 1-2% range. And it's not as if we're getting an overwhelming number of people saying, well, I would buy this, but, you know, it doesn't fit my lifestyle or something, because we're getting a lot more types of vehicles. We still are looking at appealing to innovators, which tend to have, you know, they're very risk oriented. They tend to have good financial liquidity. You know, they're the people, they're the first ones to buy things, but they're also only about 2.5% of the market themselves. So there's not very many innovator mindsets. And so I think what Ford has done with, especially with bringing out that GT, is to say, we understand the people that are buying electric vehicles right now. We understand the need to appeal to them, to have this iconic nameplate attached to it. And then just also say, but we also understand that you have a family, or that you have, you know, a practical need for this product. And that's why, you know, the crossover comes into play, especially both rear wheel drive and all wheel drive. It really just checks off a lot of boxes, and it overcomes a lot of barriers that people put up. Now, with that being said, I do still think that we continue to fight against that idea that this an electric vehicle isn't better than an internal combustion engine. And that's a discussion that needs to be had. How do, you know, as long as there's a choice, consumers will continue to choose a internal combustion engine that they're familiar with, that doesn't have perceived risk, that doesn't have that quote range anxiety, that doesn't need charging, which, you know, I've talked about the inconvenience that that can be at times. So, you know, I don't think that we're going to see electric vehicles take over the world as long as we still have internal combustion engines as a choice. But I think that the Mach-E is a really, really good step forward, especially for a traditional manufacturer like Ford.
It does advance the state of the art. The interesting thing to me that stuck out too was, or among the interesting things, was that they're saying that it's going to be profitable from job one. And if there's anything we've seen with EVs is that they are not profitable. So that's really, that makes me wonder, okay, at what volume is that going to be profitable?
Yeah, Sam, you had some good background on that, didn't you?
Yeah, so, you know, Ford, you know, as with most manufacturers, they don't like to talk about what their sales targets are or any of this stuff. But, you know, based on, you know, where this vehicle is in the market and the price point, it's, you know, it seems reasonable. I think a reasonable forecast of, you know, kind of what the sales prospects are for this particular model, you know, is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 40 to 50,000 units annually on a global basis. And, you know, when I threw that number out there, you know, nobody from Ford, you know, really seemed to flinch very much. You know, I think they would be happy with more, but I think that that's, you know, that's a reasonable number. And, you know, talking last night to Hao Tai-Tang, the head of product development at Ford, we talked about the plant where this vehicle is being built. It's in Cuautitlan, Mexico. It's the plant where they had previously built the Fiesta, and they have now ended Fiesta production there, and they're retooling that whole plant. And going back to January of 2017, when Fields first announced this, the plan was to build that compliance EV in Flat Rock, Michigan, alongside the existing Mustang. And, now what they're doing is they are retooling an entire plant. Previously has had capacity for, upwards of 250,000 vehicles a year. And it's going to be building exclusively EVs. So, this is just the first step for Ford. We already know of two other electric vehicles that they have coming, the F-150 electric, which will come along in 2021, and also from the UAW contract, an electric version of the Transit van. But there's still at least three more that are coming in the next couple of years. And, there's been some recent rumors that, we'll see a midsize SUV from Ford and Lincoln, which could potentially be a replacement for the current Edge and Nautilus, or it could be a different model entirely. The Lincoln MKZ is also coming near the end of its lifespan. So we'll probably see a Lincoln model that is, similar to this. But, what they're doing is they're preparing to sell a lot of EVs. And this particular one, because of its price point, it should be relatively, it should be certainly at least break even, I think, in the near term, and potentially profitable. Maybe not as high margin as some other vehicles, but it definitely has potential to be profitable, especially when you look at models like the GT version, which are going to be up in the $60,000 to $65,000 price range. And another thing that Hao Tai Tang mentioned is that there's going to be, because this is a mechanically simpler vehicle, and they've done a lot of things, with the new architecture of this thing to simplify it, there's going to be 25% less labor input into this vehicle. So I think there definitely is potential for profitability here.
Potential.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll get
the thing about profits is, it's all, you always have to take, the things you hear with a huge chunk of salt. It's a matter of, what you're including in that cost, what expenses, what R&D expenses and so on are you amortizing into the cost of that? In this case here, the cost of developing an electric powertrain, an electric skateboard system, the battery system, are they amortizing that just over the cost of this vehicle or over the cost of all the vehicles that are going to come out of Cuautitlan? If it's the latter, which I think is more likely, then, I think it's not unreasonable. And, with the way battery prices have been trending downwards, I think it's definitely doable.
And what volume they have left on the $7,500 tax credit?
So right now, estimate, by the end of 2019, they will be at about 120,000 units sold of plug-in vehicles.
So next month?
Yeah, by the end of December, they'll be at roughly 120,000. So they'll have about another 80,000 before the phase in period starts. And through the first part of next year, they'll still have the Fusion plug-in hybrid, the Fusion Energy, but they're also adding the Aviator Grand Touring and the Corsair Grand Touring plug-in hybrids. And then in the fall, you have the Mach-E coming. The estimate is that somewhere probably towards the end of the first half of 2021, they'll hit that 200,000 threshold. And then at that point, they have another quarter to sell an unlimited number, and then they start the phase out. So probably, by the end of September, October of 2021 is probably when you'll see the tax breaks cut in half for Ford.
Do you think that they would scale back a little bit on some of those other plug-in hybrid models in order to save some for the Mach-E?
No, I don't think so.
They don't need to scale back. They're not selling.
Yeah.
if they constrain
Fusion Energy is actually selling surprisingly well. It's actually the Fusion Hybrid and the Fusion Energy are actually a pretty significant proportion of sales of Fusion sales that are, you know, that are still there.
Oh, that's a surprise. But what are you saying though, Rebecca, like constraining supply? Like, are you talking about sort of the idea of inducing demand?
Well, no, I'm talking about preserving some of their tax credit volume for the Mach-E so that when it comes out, now, again, these are early adopter people who are, you know, wouldn't necessarily care, but it's just a nice, it's another incentive to have, you know, to be able to say, hey, you know, the first 30,000 or, you know, are still eligible. It's just a thought, just a strategy thought.
Yeah. You know, I think for roughly the first year of Mach-E production, you know, anybody who buys one in the first 12 months or so will be able to get the full tax credit. And then for another year after that, you know, they'll still have eligibility for a reduced tax credit. So we're talking, you know, well into 2022 before the tax credit goes away entirely for Ford.
Okay. And I should know this, but when is start of production?
Should be about August.
Okay.
So 2022, that's just in time for a mid-cycle refresh. So you actually got to take a ride in it. So that's also what I'm curious about is, you know, because I think the things that are going to make the Mach-E successful, the things you're going to help it versus hurt it are, you know, quality materials, the ease of use, like with the UI. And it appears that Ford has studied the things that people love about Tesla. Including like the over-the-air updates and the hands-free driver assist that'll be available at some point. And you know, what's the driving experience like, which is another thing that people rave about with their Teslas. I mean the actual physical ride. You didn't get to drive it, but you were in it. You took a spin.
Yeah, I rode shotgun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, the Mach-E is going to be available in three powertrain configurations. The base model has a 210 kilowatt. Electric rear motor, rear wheel drive. The mid-range will add a 50 kilowatt front motor, so that gives you about 335 horsepower in the mid-range model. And then in the GT, you get the same motor front and rear for a total of 459 horsepower and 630 foot-pounds of torque. And that torque, you know, as usual in electric, is instantaneous. So the prototypes that we rode in were mid-range models. So they were all-wheel drive with the smaller front motor. And, you know, they're quick. They're very quick off the line. You know, 0-60 times for this one are, you know, about the 5-second range. For the GT, you know, it's going to dip down into the mid-threes. So the GT is going to be able to accelerate in times pretty comparable to the Shelby GT500, which is currently the fastest production Mustang ever built. So, you know, similar acceleration to a GT500, you know, as an EV, because it's got the battery all in the floor, and it's got a low center of gravity. It behaves, you know, it handles quite well. We went through a slalom course, you know, and, you know, as most EVs do, it stays relatively flat, you know, it wasn't wobbling around, which is nice. So, and, you know, again, from my conversation with Dave, you know, they've really worked hard on the driving dynamics of this thing. It's got a strut front suspension, but it's got a new multi-link rear suspension setup. You know, they've done a lot of work on tuning this, you know, to make it handle really well. You know, they really want it to feel like a Mustang. And, you know, on the GT, it also has Magna Ride dampers, which will help further, you know, give a good balance of ride quality and handling. So I think, you know, overall the dynamics, you know, from the quick exposure we had, I think they're definitely on the right track. You know, the interior materials, you know, it's a nice clean design, as you can see from the images. You know, like Tesla, they've, you know, gone to fairly minimalist, you know, most of it concentrated in that 15.5-inch center display. But unlike the Model 3 and the Model Y, there's also a supplementary display right in front of the driver with the vehicle information. So you don't have to look over at the center screen to see your speed and things like that. You know, so you get that right in front of you where it belongs.
So Sam, before we move, because I want to hear more about the interior, the ride experience, because you also rode in the Porsche Taycan. So what was that like?
Well, you know, the Taycan is designed more as a sports car, you know, the four-door sports car. It's mm-hmm. it's even lower. You know, it's not a crossover. It's a lower vehicle. You know, it's also a much more expensive vehicle than this one.
Right.
You know, it's like three times, you know, a Taycan Turbo S, you know, is three times the price of a Mach-E GT.
I was kind of thinking, and I apologize, I was also sort of thinking of just a Tesla and like the Model S and the Taycan, which I haven't driven them on the Model S. I did drive in the Taycan, but I didn't know, you know, what that comparison was like.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, because the one we rode in was not the GT. You know, I think the performance of the GT is probably going to be closer to the Taycan, you know, quite a bit closer to the Taycan. It's going to be, you know, it's closer to the, it's not quite as powerful as the Taycan Turbo or the Turbo S. But you know, it's closer to that range. You know, this one, I think, you know, is the one we rode in, you know, is more in line with what you would get, you know, from a mid-range, Model 3 or, you know, what we'll probably see for the Model Y, you know, and it's quick, you know, but I wouldn't even compare it to the Taycan, but, you know, compared to other stuff that's out there, like the Jaguar I-Pace, Audi e-tron. You know, which I have driven those, you know, I would say, you know, it's at least as good, if not better performance, you know, based on that quick exposure, you know, and particularly the, you know, the I-Pace, you know, which really is designed more as a performance vehicle. It's of current production EVs, you know, the I-Pace is probably the closest in a lot of ways in terms of its configuration to the Mach-E, but it's more expensive. And, you know, while I like the interior, you know, it's more, the interior in a lot of ways of the I-Pace is more traditional, or at least contemporary Jaguar, whereas, you know, Ford has really gone more future thinking. You know, they've really gone more the Tesla direction with the Mach-E, you know, that minimalist interior, but it is very roomy. You know, it's got room for five. You know, that's the, you know, the wheelbase is 117 inches. You know, so there's plenty of leg room in there. I sat in the back seat with two other adult guys, and, you know, while, you know, our shoulders were pressed up against each other, it was not uncomfortable. You know, so three adults, you know, can sit in the back seat, you know, without any difficulty.
How were the materials?
So, you know, at this stage, you know, almost a year out from availability, you know, it's hard, certainly in the prototypes, it was hard to, you can't really judge the materials, you know, cause not everything was in finished form. And the display vehicles they had, the materials are really nice. You know, it looks like high quality stuff. And one of the things that was interesting that they were talking about was the interior materials of the Mach-E are all going to be completely animal free. So no leathers, but it's, you know, all the seats are, you know, this synthetic leather type material, the seat coverings. So there's no cloth seats in this, but it's all synthetic hides. And, you know, it looked and felt good, you know, felt like leather. You know, it looked very, very high quality. And, you know, for those that, you know, are concerned about using animal products in vehicles, you know, it, there's no animal products in there. Now, granted, there is still petroleum products in there. You know, the foams the foams and plastics are still made from petrochemicals. So it's not completely environmentally friendly, but, you know, Ford has also been a leader, you know, for more than a decade in adopting things like soy foam, you know, into their seat cushions and materials like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's really cool. I think that, and as you say, I mean, this is something that Bill Ford has spoken about before. He's very, very much an environmentalist. And I think that's really cool. There's a lot of really, really good fabrics out there. There's that can easily substitute. I mean, when you look at some of the products that they use in marine, there's plenty of really, really good synthetic leathers out there that can easily be transferred into a vehicle. There's a company called Ultra Fabric that I met the CEO, and she's really cool. We were on a plane together, and shockingly, we started talking. And but she's doing a lot more in these kinds of synthetic leathers and suedes as well that are really, really good. They have Ultra Fabric on the Lexus boat that I was on a couple months ago. That's excellent. And, you know, it's easy to clean. It's easy to live with. Again, it's sort of a practicality. And also as we move into shared vehicles, the types of fabric, you know, Sam, at that Magna event that we went to a couple weeks ago, they were talking about some different really, really good fabrics that they're working with as well. So it's definitely an area of expansion for automotive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, materials that look, you know, look good and are durable and are easy to clean are going to be crucially important for those types of vehicles. And, you know, the Ford folks, you know, the color and materials designer who's there, forget her name now, Brooke Boss, I think, you know, she talked about these materials that they developed, and, you know, they are in fact significantly more durable than natural leather. You know, but they, you know, they have that nice soft feel to them, and, you know, they're easy to clean. So I think people will like the interior of this vehicle.
And was there hard plastics, or how was that situation?
No, I mean, it was mostly, you know, certainly at least in the areas where you're touching things, you know, it was soft touch plastics. But again, I wouldn't make any judgments at this stage, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, the things that you see on a vehicle, you know, this far out from job one are not necessarily representative. So,
yeah,
you know, let's set that question aside until we've had a chance to have something that's at least closer to a pre-production model.
Sure. That screen looks almost out of proportion. That
it's
center
huge.
Console screen.
It's enormous.
It's huge. And it kind of looks like an afterthought. All I could think of was a Tim Gunn's voice with their command strips and do no harm. Like,
you know, I think it's another thing they learned from Tesla and the Model 3. Although this screen has I was really interested in this sort of rotary controller that's sort of glued to it.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of the size of the screen, it's actually smaller than the one that's in the Model S and the X, which is a 17 inch display. This is 15 and a half inches, which is okay. Just slightly larger than what's in the Model 3 and Model Y. But, you know, like you said, Dan, you know, they've kind of picked up on some of the Tesla design ethos there, you know, having it kind of floating there in the air, you know, because it is a touchscreen. You don't want it to be too far of a reach when you're trying to use it. But the other thing is that you mentioned the knob, you know, it's not an entirely touch interface. There is a control knob in the bottom center of that display. And what's interesting about that is that there's no electrical wire connection between that knob and what's behind it. The knob is actually adhesive bonded to the screen. And then there's a capacitive interface. So when you turn the knob, it's actually as if you were, you know, putting your finger on that same surface behind it and, you know, drawing circles on that surface, you know, so it's transferring the capacitive interface from your fingertips to the surface behind the knob on the screen. And so that makes it, you know, mechanically easier to manufacture it.
What's a capacitive what?
Capacitive. Basically, it's an electrical interface. Yeah. The screen on your phone is a capacitive interface, a capacitive touch interface. So, you know.
Not a flux capacitor.
No. Basically, it just means that, you know, if you've got, you know, a living object, you know, like your finger, you know, that's got electrical conductivity, you know, so you have to have electrical conductivity to that surface in order to interact with it. So, you know, if you touch it with your finger or, you know, with something else that's conductive, like a stylus that has a conductive path, or, you know, if you have gloves that have, you know, the little pads on the fingertips mm-hmm. for using your phone,
right.
What those pads are is they typically have little metal fibers in them that pass that conductivity from your fingertip to that touchscreen surface to make it work.
Oh, cool. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I do wonder what the flexivity of the human body is, though. Did they talk at all about why they went with oil-cooled motors? That really stuck out to me, too. That's the first time I've heard about that.
That's what everybody's using is oil-cooled motors.
Really? They're not public.
They use oil for cooling. Yeah, they use oil for cooling the motors. I think it's mainly, just to, the oil has enough heat capacity to act as a coolant for the motors.
Oh, I see.
So, Sam, during the last few days, because you've been out there since Thursday now, what has been the biggest positive surprise for you? And what do you think you have the most concerns about?
I would say certainly, the biggest concern is just the branding, calling it a Mustang. And certainly, if you go on Twitter and other places, you'll find lots of Mustang fans that are totally outraged at the idea of calling an electric crossover a Mustang. They're just going to have to get over it.
Porsche was horrified. Porsche people were horrified at the idea of an SUV, and now they buy them like crazy.
Porsche people were horrified by the idea of like the 356B versus the A, and it's just gone from there.
Fans in general, tend to go overboard, whatever they happen to be fans of, we certainly know how, Tesla fans can be. But the reality is, I think the thing to remember is that this is not like 1989 when Ford, was planning to replace rear wheel drive Mustang with a front wheel drive four cylinder coupe, based on a Mazda 626. That car, they ultimately saw the error of their ways there and made that car the Probe. And, we saw how that went. This is not replacing traditional Mustangs. In fact, there's a new generation Mustang coming in 2022. The traditional Mustang is going to stay with us. This is expanding the brand, and the goal is to retain what makes Mustang special, in terms of the way it drives and the way it looks, in this new form factor and this new propulsion system. One thing that obviously does change very much is the sound. One of the things that Mustang fans love, especially with the V8s, but even with engines like the four-cylinder EcoBoost, is the way they sound, that performance, that visceral feedback that you get from the way a good performance car sounds. And, they spent a lot of effort, on this one, and they're continuing. They're not finished yet, but they've spent effort on, how to make this thing sound so that it evokes that feeling of driving a Mustang. And, what they've got is that, there's actually three different modes in here. There's what they call whisper mode, which is the quiet mode. There's engaged mode, and then there's unbridled mode. And
that's clever. The unbridled.
Engaged, is in the middle between the two.
I was even thinking horse whisperer when I saw those. They got two out of three. Yeah. I didn't know what the engaged. I thought there was a better one for that.
But the unbridled mode is the loudest, and it could potentially be even, by the time they're in production, could be even louder. But what they did was they tried. Their goal was to try to create something authentic that sounds like Mustang, but also evokes the fact that it's electric. It's something different, so it's got a bit of a rumble to it. It doesn't sound like a big Mustang V8, but it's got something that evokes that performance feel to it, that visceral feel. I think they're pretty close. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, they offer an opportunity to buy different sounds for it, just as Porsche is doing with the Taycan, and have some different sound options. But I think that this one is on the right track to being a good start, because obviously anything you do in an EV is going to be synthetic, and authenticity is, there's limits on what you can call authentic in an EV. But I think they're moving in the right direction.
I read that, and I hope that they relent and offer some of us an off position. I don't want any fake sounds. Not because they're not exciting. I just want to shut it off. I don't need any more noise.
That's what whisper mode is for.
Yeah, but
it's a whisper mode.
But I will notice it, and it will annoy me. I want it off.
put headphones on. And then driving with headphones is illegal. What was the thing that was like the most delightful? Like what were you most surprised about?
Talking to us about it.
Take off your engineering hat for a second.
I think I would say that more so than the vehicle itself, kind of the real shift in the way they're doing this. It's a real transformation, or at least it appears to be from the outside, a real transformation of how they're doing product development. In the span of, 3 or 4 months after Jim Hackett came in, they completely revamped this, and they've gone from basically from scratch doing an all new vehicle, in roughly 24 months, from where we are today to when they started, when they made the decision and started down this path. It's about 2 years, and we're about 10 months out from job one. So that is a remarkably short period of time. And I think that they've the fact that they decided on a path that they wanted to go, that they wanted this to be a performance vehicle, that really excited people. And they've stuck to that vision of what they wanted this vehicle to be. And to the degree that we can judge it at this stage, with the minimal exposure we've had to it, it seems like they have largely succeeded at that. It's got a look that I think, if you're going to make a Mustang SUV, I think it's got the right look for that. Personally, I'm not a big fan of having touchscreens in cars, as you well know. But I think that what they've done so far, they seem to have executed on it very well. Now, all that said, going forward, when you look at, trying to make a decision, do you want to buy a Model Y or a Mach-E or something else? The same, Ford took that Tesla playbook of what is it about Teslas that make people want to own them? And they've largely applied that to this vehicle. And where, a company like Ford has a potential advantage is in that all that other traditional stuff of actually building the vehicle and managing supply chains and getting vehicles to customers and supporting them and providing service parts and all that stuff. And, those are the things that really separate Ford from Tesla at this stage, because the vehicle itself is not radically different from what Tesla is doing with the Model Y, in terms of the way it's architected. So, if Ford is going to succeed, they have to execute on all the stuff that they're already supposed to be good at perfectly. They have to have a clean, smooth launch with this thing, which means that they can't have the kind of screw up that they had with the Explorer launch this year. Mm. They have to do it right from job one. And if they can do that, I think that they can be successful. And I think that, with what they're doing, I think they're really demonstrating to the world that, yes, we are really serious about this electrification thing. We want to transform both the kinds of vehicles we build and the way we do business. And if they can execute on that, the rest of the way through to production, then I think, it really shows that, yeah, they have changed, that they have done something. They've made some fundamental changes in their business.
How many, do you have any read at all on how many deposits they've taken?
No, not yet. They haven't shared any information with us.
Well, Twitter says that some of us have made deposits though. People are making deposits on the car.
Yeah. Well, my friend Ravi, he did some analytics last night and it was about 70% positive response immediately after the streaming launch. And so I just didn't know if there was any, I haven't contacted him today to see if there's an update to that, but it was overwhelmingly positive at that point. But of course, money talks.
Yeah. Well, I was standing with Alex Roy last night when they unveiled the car, when he saw it for the first time in person. And, if you saw his tweets, he thought it looked effing great.
Yeah.
So
I mean, Alex actually just put up something on Twitter as well, showing both the Model Y and the Mach-E. And I think they do look very, very similar. There's fine differences I noticed. The Mach-E definitely has a longer hood, that dash to axle. dimension or measurement is definitely longer, and that gives it a little bit more proportional appeal for me. That's a big thing that I look at, and I like the Greenhouse a little bit more. It has a higher belt line. The Mach-E does, but it's incredibly similar, really.
I think that, so it's really, really clever design that Ford has done on the Mach-E, because when you look at it and you remove the color, like if you were to look at it in grayscale or some other high contrast format, you'd really see the true shape of the Mach-E. And they showed it in an environment last night that really puts it in its best light, I think, because the shape of it fools your eye. They use black trim on both the roof and the rockers to shape the colored area, and the color is what you're sort of most immediately going to notice. And the shape of that really does look like a coupe, and it works fantastically well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the keys to the success of this design. If you look at the Model Y, to me, like the X, it looks kind of bloated. It looks a little bit too tall. It's got kind of weird proportions. Whereas the Mach-E, they visually hid some of what they did in the roofline, because in order to make the back seat actually usable, have enough headroom for adults to sit back there, and there's plenty of leg room, but it's also got plenty of headroom. To achieve that, the roofline actually extends back horizontally a little bit more and goes into that, ends in that spoiler above the rear wing or above the rear glass. But then part of that, at the back, and then the body color, the frame around the window slopes down, to kind of emulate that fastback look you have on the Mustang Coupe. And then, that extended roof part is done in contrasting black that kind of visually hides it and, creates that coupe-like impression without the actual compromise of, actually doing that profile all the way down.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, it's cosmetic. And
yeah. For women, but I mean, that's okay. That's what design is,
Exactly, right?
It's both cosmetic and functional. It's like, how do you make something functional that looks good? That's, I think that they've succeeed.
Yeah. I think it looks really nice.
Well, I think we should wrap it up, but, it's really probably the most exciting day of all of 2019 for Ford to have released the Mach-E. And we'll see where it goes, but, I'd like to hear from our listeners too, what their thoughts are, whether they're Mustang purists or whether they think that, the only constant is change and we should just get over it and deal with it. Lest Ford become another Studebaker. And so let us know what you think. And I'm sure we'll be back on the Mustang Mach-E beat the next episode as well.
Yeah
we'll, don't forget we'll be talking about this for at least the next year.
Yeah, exactly. And don't forget to that you can follow us on Twitter now at Tweet Car Reviews, and we'll be having some comments on there as well.
Oh, all right. It sounds like you're going to say, we'll let you take over the account.
Okay. Well, we're getting followers.
I know. It's super great. Fun. I really enjoy reviewing cars in that format. I think it's nice and immediate. So.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. So.
All right.
All right.
Talk to you all next time.
Well, thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.